And you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National and through those gizmos that Steve made for you. In Britain, it's conference time. The Tories, Labour and the Liberal Democrats have had their set pieces. And at the latter was a real scientist, one with Australian characteristics, as the Chinese would say. Dr. Julian Huppert is MP for Cambridge and has two Australian parents, both professors at Cambridge. And he's even represented Australia at the Chemistry Olympics. So what's it like in politics?
I mean, truly bizarre in every way. I mean, Westminster is a very, very strange place, with very historical. It doesn't really make sense. You know, people still communicate as though the quill pen was the main form of communication. It's still the technology we have to get information across the road, literally, is to print it out, carry it across and hand it to somebody. It's very, very bizarre. I didn't think I'd find something that was more antiquated than Cambridge colleges, but it manages it somehow. But there's also a large cultural change in terms of the way people think. In politics, you can never say you don't know something, but also U-turns are considered a massive weakness. You come up with an idea, consult, withdraw from it, that shows weakness. In science, anybody who comes up with an idea and never ever retracts from it is a really bad scientist. You know, it's all about, here's my hypothesis, test it. Oh, well, that one didn't work. Fine, no problem.
Well, I'm reminded of the very person who was in this college, Maynard Keynes, who said, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do?
Absolutely. And the general political style is, by both sides, I'm not making party political comments, is to pick on a fact and stick to it. You work out what your conclusion is, find a fact that supports it, and public policy being so inexact, you can normally find some survey somewhere that says what you want it to say, and then stick to it, whatever happens.
What about the change of circumstance from science itself and being a politician?
It's also very different. I mean, there's much less attention to detail in some senses, which I find somewhat frustrating. But I mean, one of the criticisms about science, of course, is that people do sometimes over-concentrate on details. Details are actually very important, which is why you'll do it and why I did it when I was a scientist. In politics, there isn't time to do that. You can't specialise that small, particularly when you have constituents and you have to deal with all of their issues. So a typical day will be dealing with almost anything. You can't be a specialist in all of it. So you have to be happy to be able to be a bit more general and to pick things up quickly and then move on.
Are you the only person in the House of Commons who is an ex-practicing scientist?
There are two of us with science PhDs. I'm the only one who then went on to practice. I mean, it depends exactly how you define it. There's a science teacher or two, there's a medical doctor or two, a few of them actually. But I'm the only one who sort of had that research career from a PhD.
And what about the change from being a Liberal Democrat who was elected to be a Liberal Democrat with your agenda and suddenly finding yourself, so to speak, in bed with the Tories?
Well, it's the same room but different beds, I think. So it's a fascinating. I mean, again, it's a difference between politics and the real world. All of us work in places where you reach agreements with other people. You know, I'd like to do things this way, the other person in the office would like to do it that way. We work something out. In politics, that's an odd thing to do, apparently. Whereas actually, I think it's part of a more mature system. It's hard work. We have to fight much harder. Part of making a deal, whether it's a business deal, a political deal, anything else, is you have to do things that you didn't want to do. But if you've ever gone out for dinner with a group of friends, you know, you went to the restaurant you didn't really like, that's what happens. We've actually been quite successful, though nobody really spots this. I think the latest study I saw showed, an independent one said that we'd now implemented 3/4 of our manifesto, which is pretty good. I mean, we've typically managed to get 0% implemented for 50 years or so. So actually getting 3/4 of it is quite good. We told the country there were 4 main things that we wanted to do. 3 of them are happening. The 4th one, well, we lost the vote on AV. Everybody told us Australia hated AV and it didn't work. I mean, you know, load of rubbish. But
that's the voting system we have in Australia.
Absolutely. And it was fascinating. Somebody who knows Australia reasonably well to hear all the comments made in Britain about it, which didn't fit with anything I'd ever heard from any Australian.
What were the 3 things you did get up?
So our 4 areas. The first one was about a fairer taxation system. So lifting the poorest paid out of tax completely. That's happening. Every year we'll lift more and more people. We've lifted 1 million people out of paying any income tax at all. The next one was about the green economy, having a more balanced economy. So we've done that. The Green Investment Bank, we're the first country, I believe, to have set a carbon budget out to the end of the next decade, showing 50% reduction in carbon emissions, a fair start for children, so giving more money for schools that take children from disadvantaged backgrounds, nursery places for 2-year-olds, there's a whole range of things around that. And the 4th was changing the way the electoral system works, the political system works. We didn't win the AV thing. We're hopefully going to get change to the House of Lords, which is a bizarre anachronism that we still have, one of many. And there are a number of other things we're still working on in that area.
Talking about Lords, two Lords have been to Australia quite recently. One of them, Lord Monckton, who's been on the road considerably. And you'd never know he came from Britain because he seems not to feature here.
I mean, he's just largely quite eccentric. I mean, if I remember correctly, he's now had a formal letter from the House of Lords saying he may not describe himself as a member of the House of Lords, which is a fairly unusual step. But no, he's not a significant person I've ever really heard discussed here.
It's amazing because he's highly significant in Australia. How do you think you can account for that?
I would never excuse Australians of being deferential. Perhaps the title matters more in Australia. But it's more just being from somewhere else, he can build up an atmosphere there that he doesn't really have here. He can. I don't know the details. I don't know very much about him at all. I've just heard a few comments.
And the other Lord being Lord Lawson, Nigel Lawson, who used to be the Chancellor of the Exchequer under Margaret Thatcher, and very much involved with the questioning of climate change. He now says that climate change is happening, but not much, and we should adjust. It's a great contrast to the way climate change is discussed in this country. Do you find it surprising that Nigel Lawson has seeming traction in Australia as well?
Yes, I mean, again, it's possibly that people aren't as familiar with his legacy. So he possibly has a better reputation where people don't know him so well. I'm glad that he's moved onwards. I mean, he's seen here as being sort of very much on the extreme fringe. So if he's become more rational about some of this, that's clearly a good thing, which I'd welcome. But he's a very unusual character in a whole lot of ways. Yeah. I agree with him on some things. But
you agree with him on some
things? Yeah, we're on a group looking at drugs policy reform together. So that's one area of agreement, but you know, he was an arch Thatcherite. He did a lot of that. And as the president of the Liberal Democrats said, he's realised that actually Liberal Democrats and Conservatives have quite a lot in common. We all joined our parties because of Margaret Thatcher, just that they agreed and we disagreed.
Carbon taxes are big news, of course, in Australia. Debates go on. And there is some question as to whether Australia is going out on a limb by being first. Now, it seems not to have noticed that Europe has been doing this for some time. Do you have a view on whether Australia is in some ways leaping ahead of its own ability to cope?
I haven't kept a very close eye on exactly what's happening. The general view is that Australia is very much behind what everyone else is trying to do and needs to catch up. So if Australia is trying to move faster on this, then I think that's really good. It's fundamentally a simple economic question, that there are externalities, there are things which aren't factored in, and they should be factored in. It's a really good way to do things. It also means that if you collect money from carbon taxation by taxing bad things, you can reduce the equivalent amount of taxation on other things which matter more to people. There's lots of ways of doing that.
And give a boost to green technology, you mean?
The green technology, absolutely. There is a huge market for people who will develop new things. I was at a Cambridge company this morning who's doing a lot of work on smart grids and smart meters, which obviously fit in with photovoltaic and so forth. There is a really good business to be made, and there's lots and lots of these in a whole range of areas. A number of countries are really engaging in that. Britain's doing some. Germany's been doing a lot. China's really doing quite a bit. If Australia chooses to ignore that, it may find that it hasn't got a chair where the music stops.
So you're saying that there are lots of technologies which need to get the green light, so to speak, and they can take off because they'll have the financial backing. Have you got any particular ones in view that might really go terribly well?
There's a whole range. I mean, in Australia, I'd have thought it would be a fantastic site for large-scale desert photovoltaics. The US is looking at doing some of this. There are a number of companies working very hard because they see the financial benefits in it. Europe doesn't have the same sort of access. The Northern Sahara is a slightly trickier area to have large-scale engineering works. But Australia would be a very good site for doing something like that.
Offshore wind, there's also onshore wind, in other words, on the land-based, and highly political, both in Australia and here. Lots of people who have land hate those great big turbines. Is that more political, or is it genuinely, do you think, a health question?
I'm sure in some cases it's a genuine health question, but I think a lot of it is that there are things which people would rather not have. And there's no doubt that the best way of generating energy is a magic energy source that doesn't sit anywhere, doesn't produce any waste products and is free. We haven't yet developed that. I mean, we're 25 years away from having nuclear fusion. We've been about 25 years away from it for 50 years now. Someday we'll be only 20 years away. So this is just the challenge. There's an excellent book by David Mackay, who is academic in Cambridge who I've collaborated with, who's now the chief scientific advisor to the Department of Energy and Climate Change, published an excellent book called Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, freely available to download. And he has a wonderful map of Britain where he shows in black everywhere that's within a mile, I think, of a settlement. He says all the areas in black are close to settlement, so he couldn't possibly do anything there. All the areas in white are natural areas, so he couldn't possibly do anything there. And the point he's making is there isn't a perfect solution, but we need to get energy somehow.
He's a mathematician, is he not?
He was in the physics department, the Cavendish Laboratories, where I was, but he Bayesian statistician is his original background.
Yeah. Now, that's really the umbrella idea that unites all these things you're talking about. At what point do you have sufficient information on scientifically or technologically based matters to make firm policy? In other words, you never have enough information. You're never absolutely sure about climate. You're never absolutely sure about whether turbines do or do not make people feel unwell. And you are now in Parliament where you've got to make those decisions. How do you go about it?
It's a real challenge. There's one, the problem of the timescale for getting information. And you're absolutely right, we often have to make decisions before we know. Can you safely store carbon dioxide underground? Well, ideally, we test it for 1,000 years first. We don't have 1,000 years to wait. So you have to do some sort of modelling. So one issue is about the timing. The other issue is actually that a lot of public policy decisions are not scientific decisions. They can be informed by science and engineering, and they very much should be. I'm a big advocate of that. But ultimately, they often involve trade-offs. And science can't tell you how much beauty is worth how much electricity. It comes down to what you believe, ultimately, and how you set your values up. So there is this real challenge of trying to make often early decisions on incomplete information, where there are just values that really do make a difference. I try to put more weight, I think, on the evidence than some of my colleagues do. I mean, there are a number of people in Parliament who are quite good. There's a few who are very, very strange on some of these issues. So we should look at the best evidence there is now, but accept that there's uncertainty.
And that uncertainty is exploited by certain people from certain political groups. They're trying to undermine the science. And in fact, you may well have seen a film made by Sir Paul Nurse, the president of the Royal Society of London, called Science Under Attack. Do you have an opinion about the ways in which science is specifically being attacked by political forces?
It's very much happening. I haven't actually seen that film. But there is an agenda to try to displace science as being a trusted voice. I mean, there's been a whole lot of surveys about which are trusted voices scientists traditionally were. And there is part of it is that we have failed to communicate well enough with the public. We haven't educated people, I think, in understanding what science is and what it isn't. Think for themselves, really, about how to evaluate things. People should be questioning scientists. People shouldn't say, I heard a scientist say this, therefore it must be true. They should have the tools, if they wish to think about some of these issues. And I think we haven't really managed to do that. And hence people have almost been trapped into making very black and white statements.
Here we are in an era where, as far as I'm concerned, it's the first time I can remember when people have no real sense of future. There's no utopianism, which is probably a good thing, in politics. There's no promised land people are working towards. It's as if we're all very confused by these various things, many of which are global. I mean, we can't just think about the suburb or the local town or what's up the road. Have you a view about whether this is going to last for a long time or whether we can actually change it ourselves by doing, as you describe, coming to terms with some of these difficulties?
I mean, I hope we'll move into a better space. I mean, I think the world has been rocked by quite a few things now, and we hadn't somehow quite anticipated some of the effects that mass globalisation, very rapid communications would have. And there's still a lot of shockwaves, I think, resulting from all of that. I think people will. I mean, I hope we'll move into a society which has slightly different ways of thinking. For example, we've spent a few decades very much with the focus being on financial return. I think more and more there's a movement, certainly it's quite strong now in Britain, to look at how is your country doing, not just based on GDP. So I'm very pleased the government started to look at well-being indicators and to start to measure those, doing proper surveys. And to really take quite seriously that actually what matters to people is not just how much cash do they have, but what's their quality of life. Most people would rather live in a nice place near their friends than have a bit more spare money. You know, we know this about people, that their choices aren't just about how much money they can get. But for governments to really start to appreciate that. So where you've been pushing for that quite hard within this government, I hope we'll try to move things so people can take pleasure from more things.
You haven't seen the TV series In the Thick of Things?
In the Thick of It, I have indeed, yes.
Is it like that?
It's funny. Politics is a mixture of that, of Yes Minister, of the House of Cards. There's a whole range of different aspects to it. It's fascinating. The real thing that I've learned is to get something to happen in politics, you have to change it before it's said. Once a minister announces something, it's too late. So the real trick is to know what will be announced next month and get it changed before it's said.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Dr. Julian Huppert, MP for Cambridge, with me at King's College. He was last on The Science Show talking about four-stranded DNA.